Hey, thank you very much, Erica. I'm delighted to be here, actually. Very glad that you invited me. Thanks very much. As Erica said, I'm a linguist, okay? So I'm a relative newcomer to human-animal studies. And I'm going to talk about this theme, tasting, from a number of different angles, but I want to bring in some linguistic evidence and hope to convince you that linguistics has something to offer to human-animal studies. Just before I leave this slide, I still do love the taste. I'll come back to this later on. It's a quotation from a focus group of mixed focus group of meat eaters and vegetarians. That's a meat eater talking about eating meat. Still, that's something about the past, isn't it? And love, that's something about emotions. I'll come back to this in a second. So the structure of my talk is like this, okay? I'm going to talk first of all about tasting as an experience, just some general reflections, then about taste as a word, that's the linguistics part of it, and then thirdly about taste as a reason, in scare quotes, that is to say, a reason that people give for eating meat. So to start off with, I'm very fortunate to be the first speaker, but I apologize if someone else was hoping to use this later on. But I'm going to begin with what is probably the most famous literary account of a taste, and that is Marcel Proust, who as an adult was suddenly taken back to Marcel Proust as a boy by the taste, very famous taste, of a piece of Madeleine cake dipped into a tisane or a cup of tea. And this is a translation of that episode, a very, very famous episode in literature indeed. I won't read it to you, but you can see it okay to read, I hope. Yeah, okay. So it's the description of what happened to him, right? And there are a number of very interesting aspects of this, okay? So first of all, it's a very sensual or sensuous account, okay? He's talking about a warm liquid that touched his palate. It caused a shudder and an exquisite pleasure, okay? And then at the end, looking through these underlined bits, it's not the sight of the piece of cake dipped into the tea that takes him suddenly back to his childhood, but the taste, okay? So there is something particularly powerful about taste in terms of sensual pleasure and in terms of memory that he seems to capture here. It's a visceral experience, a very sensual experience, and a very pleasurable one. So the theme of that is something about the relationship between taste and sensuality and memory. But this is actually not just Proust. I mean, maybe Proust is the person who said it in the most famous and memorable way. I have a student at the moment who is researching the language of food cookery books, okay? And she's got a corpus, that's to say a collection of words that have been used that can be analyzed, of descriptions of desserts by famous women food writers, so kind of Delia Smith and Nigella Lawson and Mary Berry and that sort of people, those sort of people. And very frequently in this, her name is Daniel Courtney, by the way, very frequently in this corpus you get the same kind of correlation. So you get these kind of things run through the corpus a lot. The pink milkshake tastes so much of my childhood, okay? So it's the taste of these desserts, these women food writers claim, that take them back to the past. And again, described in, you know, excessive terms of pleasure. Not just the personal past, okay, not just the childhood of those people, but also the past in the sense of tradition, of something that is kind of from our past as a society, maybe, okay. So this phenomenon, this ability of taste to have to work particularly as a way of evoking memories, okay, and causing extreme pleasure is an interesting phenomenon. I've not said anything yet about the taste of meat. I'm going to come on to that later on. I'm so far just talking about cakes and puddings, okay? But what kind of explanations can there be? Well, it's quite interesting to look at the biology of tasting, first of all. I'll come on to the linguistics of tasting in a minute. The biology of tasting, here's a rather explicit picture, okay? So, taste, right? This is just stuff I've picked up off Wikipedia, to be honest, okay? But what is taste, okay? Taste is something that happens on the tongue, right? Inside our mouths, right? it strikes me that a difference between taste and the other senses is that it's not shared, okay? I could have something in my mouth and be tasting it, and you don't share that sensation in the way that we are all seeing and hearing the same things in our environment, okay? What happens biologically is apparently that clusters of receptor cells pick up, react to dissolve molecules of substance in the mouth, and that is relayed to neurons in the brain. Again, apparently, I'm still on the Wikipedia kind of level here, okay? Infants, neonates, can distinguish tastes very, very early before they can order their data from other senses, from sight and sound and so on. They begin to structure the different types of taste. And scientists identify now five particular kinds of taste that the tongue will relay. There is, again, if you stick to the biology of it, apparently, and it seems feasible, an evolutionary aspect to this, because if you're going to ingest something into your body, it's potentially fatal, okay? And therefore, the young child needs to discriminate between tastes very quickly. And again, I kind of surmise that's also to do with that business of sharing. The carer, the parent, can protect a neonate from sights and sounds, but tastes are made, well, later than neonate for obvious reasons. But the infant, okay, tastes are dangerous. Tastes are dangerous. Food is dangerous. And that links into the thing that I'm sure, you know, we're all very familiar with, that there is a kind of irrational aspect to what people will and won't eat. So in a certain society, certain things are acceptable for breakfast. People eat bacon, but not lamb chops. Okay, people, and certain kinds of meats are acceptable in certain societies, as we all know, and not others. Most famously, recently in Britain, beef and lamb, but not horse meat. Okay, so this element of wanting to be safe with your memories, your childhood identity, the foods that you know, that you can trust, and all that sort of thing, that's very much locked in, I think, with the biology of tasting. But there's also, of course, a sociology of tasting. Now, the most famous sociological work on taste is Bourdieu's book about taste, which people are very familiar with, I'm sure. And Bourdieu, to a large extent, is dealing with the metaphorical meaning of taste. So taste as discrimination, good taste. Someone has taste in furniture, paintings, or whatever. But Bourdieu is also, which is, by the way, actually, I thought maybe this was one of the reasons this theme of this meeting is tasting and not taste, so we didn't get confused between physical taste and tasting is always about the food. You can't say, I'm tasting this painting, can you? Okay, but Bourdieu also is talking about physical food, childhood taste as well. So he says that taste, the phenomenon of taste which defines social groups, is most marked in the ordinary choices of everyday existence, such as furniture, clothing, or cooking. So he does talk about food as well. And food is the strongest and most indelible mark of infant learning. And we make our choices and stick to them from earliest childhood, okay? So taste, again, if you look at a kind of sociology of taste, this notion that our most fundamental identities, our sense of self, our sense of security, who we are, this is all linked in with taste. And lots of sociologists, of course, moving on to meat now, have talked about correlations between concepts, particularly of masculinity and meat. So these two, I'm sure, you are very familiar with. More recently, I read recently a very entertaining and deceptively light, I say deceptively light because it's actually a very serious book, but also entertaining and light, The Language of Food, which is a research-based book by Dan Jurafsky, a computational linguist. He did things like analyze 7 million, automatically obviously, 7 million restaurant reviews, and he finds out that if you have a positive review, if it basically, he seems to find out as an empirical fact, okay? If a woman likes the dessert, she likes the restaurant, okay? If a man likes the meat, he likes the restaurant, okay? So maybe there's some, you know, some empirical basis for these kind of things. A couple of psychology articles recently, this Luffman et al. Shows a kind of statistical psychology, which I can't follow, to be honest, but I'll read the conclusions to the article. Some correlation between people's claim to find masculinity important and whether they like meat. And then another one, this is a very interesting article actually, is meat male? One of the parts of this which interested me is trying to make a correlation between the gender of words in different languages, the gender of words related to meat, okay, and whether they tend to be masculine more than feminine. Okay, you can think of exceptions like la viande, okay, and there's all sorts of problems about relating grammatical gender to sex differences, but there is something of a correlation. So these kind of sociological things about preferences and so on running through lots of things. Now this is all by way of introduction, okay? And as I said, I'm a newcomer to some of these things, and certainly I didn't know anything about taste as a sense before I was asked to give this paper, okay? So let me now move on to taste as a word, okay? And my hope is that people will come to see that linguistics has something to offer to animal studies. And I'm going to use some evidence about the word taste to make the points that I want to go on and make. I think it should be fairly self-evident that language choices and ideological stances in general and in relation to food and in relation to animals have some kind of mutually illuminating function, okay? To give you a couple of examples from the project that I'm involved in at the moment that I'm going to talk about in a bit more detail later. We recently interviewed Amanda Baker, who is a leading spokesperson for the Vegan Society. I can't remember her exact job title. And we did a very interesting interview, very intelligent and aware interviewee. We discussed with her preferred vocabulary for talking about animals. So if you can see that, I won't read through this, okay? So she is, if you like, campaigning for animal rights and also campaigning for a change in the language. And we discussed with her lots of problems about this, of course, because she has to engage with people who don't like these terms, who don't want to use these terms, who don't understand these terms sometimes. And she herself also didn't grow up using these terms, so there's this phenomenon of kind of, you know, she wants to say companion animals, but every now and then she says pets by accident and so on. So, you know, this is something of an issue, what language we choose to use to talk about animals. And of course there are no neutral choices. I'm saying animals, some people would prefer me to say non-human animals, okay. Another thing, I mean, for example, in the project, I'm also going to mention a lot of things, yeah, in a bit. One of the things which emerges is that in almost every sphere of human interaction with animals, humans kill animals, including having pets, where pets are killed because they are, for reasons, okay, they are regarded as surplus to requirements, as they say in animal experiments. Or unwanted or ill or whatever, and you come across some, I think, quite extraordinary euphemisms, as you do indeed with human death. So the ultimate kindness is killing in this case. And all sorts of different words crop up in our data relating to the killing of animals, and there's variation there depending on the genre, Well, lots and lots of factors determine which word people choose, okay? So it seems to me, and the premise of my research at the moment is, that language has, you know, can provide very, very interesting insights into people's stances towards animals. So I'm going to say something now about the kind of research that I do and have done. It's called, I like to call it, three-dimensional discourse analysis, with this hopefully kind of catchy acronym 3DDA. And what happens in three-dimensional discourse analysis is we have three sources of information. So we have, first of all, what we're trying to correlate is what is said, right? The language that is actually used about a particular topic. By whom, right? What can we say about the people who write or speak this language? And to whom? What can we say about the people who receive this language, who interpret it, who react to it? So to do this, we use three kinds of data. This is not particularly bad. I mean, this can be used on different things, as I'll say in a second. We have what are called corpora in linguistics. Corpus linguistics is a branch of linguistics which uses the automatic analysis of enormous databases of language that has actually been used. Some corpora, I guess it sizes everything. Some corpora are in the billions of words, okay? But it enables linguists to come up with facts about patterns and occurrences of words which they were not previously able to do. By whom, in the research I do, we correlate this with interviews, okay? So we interview people who produce certain types of language about certain topics, in the case of my current project about animals. And then thirdly, 3DDA, three-dimensional discourse analysis, tries to find out how people react to what has been said by holding focus groups and asking people to react to the language that is used. There are lots of methodological pitfalls in this. One being that you can't trust what people say. Sometimes they tell you lies, or sometimes they put forward an image of themselves that is not in particularly, you know, people like to present themselves in a focus group as much nicer than they actually are. But anyway, okay. So I've used this kind of methodology in a series of research projects over the years, over quite a long period of time now. All mostly to do with food politics, okay? So I've looked at various controversial topics about food, right? Baby food labels, I won't go into the reasons why these are controversial, but formula milk labels are very controversial for various reasons. GM food is the controversial is a bit of an understatement. Organic food promotion, I looked at one project on that, and then the school dinners debate. But the one of these that I'm going to draw on today is the organic food promotion, because some of organic food is meat, obviously. And then currently, I'm in the middle of a three-year project called People, Products, Pests and Pets, the Discursive Representation of Animals, which is running at King's College London, where I work, together at Lancaster University. My co-investigator is Professor Alison Seeley. And we are using this methodology to look at the way people talk and write about animals. So to do this, we have a corpus, a series of corpora, which are not enormous by corpus linguistics standards, but they are big enough to reveal patterns of word choices, what kind of words, what kind of phrases occur in certain kind of contexts, and how might one relate them to certain practices and activities and beliefs about animals. So we have a lot of scientific journal articles, including a lot about animal experiments, campaign materials from people with, you know, campaigning on for hunting, against hunting, or whatever. Marketing materials, meat marketing materials. The Mass Observation Archive is a very interesting thing, I don't know if you know about it, where people are invited to send in written reflections on a particular topic. So we have 174,000 words of people reflecting on the role of animals in their lives. Transcripts of wildlife documentaries, newspaper articles, zoo leaflets or whatever, not very much. And then the interviews and focus groups, which I'm going to mention now, double up, if you see what I mean, as part of this corpus. Am I making sense? There's a problem with interdisciplinarity. You never know whether you're making sense to people or not, okay? To me, it seems very straightforward. I hope I'm making sense anyway. Then we've conducted a lot of interviews, both with organisations and individuals. So we have interviewed three very eminent broadcasters. Everybody wants to know about David Attenborough, of course. It's the highlight of our project. And then various groups. So the Countryside Alliance is a pro-hunting group. Two organic farming concerned with organic meat, Soil Association and the Laverstock Park Farm Organic Abattoir. Various campaign groups for animal rights or for animal welfare. This is where it says animal rights organisation. We have two interviews where the person we interviewed, they're all leading spokespeople or heads of these organisations. A leading animal rights organisation who did not want to be on record. Okay, we can quote the transcript, but we mustn't say who they are. The others are all named and on record. The British Pest Control Association, and then two organisations and one individual defending the case for animal experiments. Sir Colin Blakemore is a leading exponent of experiments. And then that's the other organisation that didn't want to be named, a leading meat, non-organic meat marketing organisation. It's rather interesting that the two organisations who didn't want to be named in our data are, as it were, at opposite wings, if you like. I could say something, it's not to do with my talk, but I have some thoughts on that. The Badger Trust, so those are the interviews which we have conducted, yeah. And then we hold focus groups. No pretty pictures with these, I'm afraid. So we have some focus groups which are by age, 18 to 23 year olds and over 60s. And the others are, we don't have any children, all adult groups. The others are by job, people who handle animals, or by opinion, people who support animal rights, or by practices, vegetarians. We have a mixed group of vegetarians and meat eaters. Focus groups with people who carry out animal experiments, hunters and fishermen, and they were men, okay? I put fishermen because they were men, okay? And fishers sounds a bit weird to me as a term, but anyway, there we are. And butchers. So those are our focus groups. We held two focus groups with each of those, okay? And in the focus group, I'm going to go forward and then I'll come back to that slide. So this is an extract. This is where I get the title of this talk from. This is the kind of thing you get in focus groups. So this is mixed meat eaters and vegetarians. They were very friendly, actually. In fact, one of the meat eaters is married to one of the vegetarians. You get this kind of thing. I don't like pork, but I quite like whole roasts. But if it's an actual pig, I'm like, yeah, it's really weird. The only reason I don't eat meat now is because I can see the animal. Like, I used to love black pudding, haggis, like I still do love the taste of them, don't get me wrong, probably, but it's the visualization of what I'm eating and the animal that just stops me now. I just can't go near it. So you see, there's another speaker. So you see, Hog Roast says to me, happy pig. I don't know why. Happy pig with a spike through it. Okay. So this is the kind of thing we get in our focus group data. One interesting problem is we get lots of people caricaturing the other side, okay? So if somewhere in our data we've got something like, oh, it's just like Bambi, I couldn't possibly eat it, right? Who is that speaking? That's a hunter, it's a gamekeeper, actually, mocking animal rights and animal welfare. Okay? So you get this all the time, actually, so it's quite... in fact, in this focus group, I nearly used this for the title of this talk, I just love the taste of bacon or something like that, and it's somebody mocking meat eaters, okay? So we get all this data and we can do all sorts of things with it, with this corpus linguistic software. Well, this is actually from the qualitative data analysis program Envivo. You can see how a word, and the word I'm looking at is taste. Actually, the word tasting doesn't crop up in our data very much, if at all, I think. So I've reverted to taste. And then you can follow through certain, you know, how, which of those two sides. So here, why we somebody said, why we carry on killing pigs is because people like the taste of pig meat, and therefore that is killing for pleasure. That's somebody arguing against meat eating. And other things we can do. Now, this is one of the major things that linguists do nowadays, okay? We take all this data and we can see how a particular word behaves, right? This is called a concordance. So you set up every occurrence of the word in a line in the middle and you can see what goes with it, okay? These are all the occurrences of the word taste in the group I just mentioned, the mixed vegetarians and meat eaters. And there's something that leaps out from this, and if you actually, any corpus of conversational or informal data will have the same thing with the word taste. I'll show you some more examples. Taste, the word taste, is almost always what is called a collocate, that a frequent companion. Collocation in linguistics means words that frequently go together. Of some kind of emotional response. People love the taste, like the taste, hate the taste, it tastes better, it tastes great, okay? These are the words that go with taste, right? Wherever you look. This is a bigger, well, this is a very big concordance. I think it's something off the web. It's in the many millions, okay? And there you can see it again. So if you can read that, like the taste, liked the taste, prefer the taste, crave the taste, miss the taste, felt the taste, hate the taste, and you know, taste is something to do with liking and disliking, right? Almost everywhere that you look. Except that, this is from our corpus of scientific articles. They're not all about animal experiments, some of them are about, well, all sorts of things, farming and so on. You don't get that here, right? So it's in kind of conversational, face-to-face data, the mass observation, the focus groups, this kind of thing, that you get this taste is a matter of emotion. In science, okay, it's not so much a matter of emotion. There's nothing there that is particularly emotional. They're just sort of things that scientists talk about, kind of dry. Okay, can you read this okay? It's a screenshot, so it's not ideal in that respect. So in other words, it seems that there's a sort of genre dependence. It depends on the nature of the relationship, the nature of interaction. But if you're talking about anything that's remotely conversational, interpersonal, when taste comes up, it's a way that people talk about their likes and their dislikes. Now I'm going to move from there to food marketing language, okay? And I'm drawing now on the project I mentioned, the Organic Food Project. Although, not that it's of particular interest to you, but the data from the for Organic Food Project, the data about meat, has become part of the project, People, Products, Pests and Pests project. Such a tongue twister. So in food marketing, which is not conversational data, but food marketers are trying to get you to do things, right? They're trying to be persuasive, to work on your emotions and so on. Taste is a big thing, okay? Food marketing language can be characterized, I think, by these qualities. It aspires to be poetic, it likes to be vague, sensual, it's selective about facts. There are, of course, legal constraints. You can't just say anything you want in food marketing, it's got to be true, but food marketers avoid things that they don't want you to know, or they push them to the side, as in those famous cases which you may have noticed where you get British potatoes with a Union Jack, and then if you look somewhere, it says from Israel, or something of the kind, because the law about what you have to do to describe something as British is a little bit tricksy. It tends to be personalized, it likes to tell stories, and it tends to be conversational. And it's aimed at people's self-interest, right? Save money, have pleasure, you know, please your kids, whatever, right? So in keeping with this, food marketing language is also very fond of stressing taste and its pleasures. Again, not meat, chocolate. Masterfully prepared sweetened real fruit juice pieces made from a blend of pomegranate and other select concentrated fruit juices. That's linguistically rather overindulgent, I think. It's a single noun phrase, right? Very, very complicated one. Are dipped in our creamy pure dark chocolate to create this decadent taste sensation, okay? So it all seems to be kind of in keeping with everything else, with Proust and food writers and all of this kind of thing. Even the Soil Association, this was their list of 10 reasons to eat organic at one point, okay? And then, I think this is a problem for the Soil Association actually, because they are a marketing organisation as well as a campaign of organic agriculture. They decided to move Top for Taste to the top of their list, right? Because they thought that's why people want to eat organic. You know, we're always told to have impact in academic research. I'm now going to tell you about the impact of my research, okay? It's the only impact I've ever had. I've been an academic for 40 years. Oh, sorry, they moved Top for Taste back down the list for a few months after having a briefing from me. So I haven't had much impact. That's the upshot of all that. Okay. But if you look, so I think this is kind of indicative, right? This is the Soil Association, which ought really to be concentrating on things like good for wildlife and the environment, is also seduced by this notion of taste. And if you look at food marketing, you can do another thing with corpus linguistics software. You can take two corpora and you can show what words in one are unusually frequent with reference to the other one. Okay, if you just say what words are frequent, you just get the big, small. Okay, but these are the kind of words that come up in food marketing, including meat food marketing, a lot. Okay, taste words. And here's an example from organic meat marketing. Can you read that?
Mm-hmm.
Waterstones. Wrong shop. Waitrose organic chipolatas are made from selected cuts of belly and shoulder of pork from organically reared English pigs. And there's the pigs, looking happy. The pork is coarsely chopped and blended with herbs and spices to produce succulent and full-flavoured chipolatas. So succulent and full-flavoured, okay. There's a big emphasis on families in food marketing, especially meat marketing, actually, both the families of the animals, so the family of pigs. The backside of this label is all about the happy family of pigs. But also the families of the farmers. So there's a, in organic food marketing, meat marketing particularly, well, no, food marketing in general, every farm is a family enterprise, you know. It's father and son and all this kind of stuff, okay. We had to give you an example of this three-dimensional discourse analysis, we had a very amusing thing with this label. So we interviewed a person who writes these labels, and she said, I know this packaging, and I know that, yes, succulents a difficult word, but how the hell do you give the sense of flavour without words like that? So all taste-oriented. I spend a lot of my time making sure that what I write is factually accurate, so to speak, but also hopefully presses those nice, touchy, feely buttons, which I actually think is part of the reasons why consumers buy organic. It's the feel-good factor. Okay? So totally sort of behaviourist, condescending, you know, why do people buy things? Because they're emotional beings and you just say the right word and they'll buy it, okay? And the word they want to hear is succulent. But we had a rather amusing thing because we then use the text, we interview the person who wrote it, we analyse the text, and then we show it to a focus group, in this case young adults, that I wouldn't buy something that said the word succulent on it because for me that conjures up images of fat, okay? And then a reaction to the whole package was, it's only sausages. So you can get some quite amusing things out of this, I think. How am I doing for time, Erica?
You have about 7 minutes.
Oh, good. That should be fine, okay. So now I move on to my third thing. So I've said something about tasting as an experience. I've said something about taste as a word, and in the context of how I hope language analysis can say something about, you know, has some relevance to animal studies. But now, I want to just reflect and to warn you in a rather inconclusive way, because it's something I don't know the answer to, but I know what the question is, if you like, okay, about tastiness as a reason to eat something, and in particular as a reason to eat meat. And we've seen that when you talk to people about eating meat, taste figures very strongly. Meat eaters say, I love the taste, okay, and non-meat eaters sometimes say, I hate the taste, or I love the taste, but I still don't want to eat it. And we've seen that marketers think that tastiness is how they're going to get you, okay, it's tasty, right? So how does this relate to arguments for and against eating meat? Well, when we interviewed David Attenborough, eloquent as ever, okay, he came up with two of the reasons that one frequently hears put forward for eating meat. I mean, if there were such a thing as biological morality, which is a questionable concept, okay, but if there were, then one might say that biologically one is adapted to omnivory, and that my teeth, my guts, and so on entitle me to eat meat. It's a questionable bit of logic, but that's what I think. And indeed, one knows of kids who doctors say, you're not well, and the reason why you're not well is because you're not having a balanced diet. And by balanced diet, they don't mean vegetarianism, okay? So two reasons given there. It's we've evolved to do it, and it's healthy, okay? Here's a nice quotation from one of the focus groups. I don't remember which one, I'm afraid. I think it's the same one. I like meat too much, but I couldn't. Of course, when people speak, when you transcribe what people actually say, it doesn't come out as terribly grammatical, even David Attenborough. I like meat too much, I couldn't. I like the taste of it. I think it's part of our, we're genetically meant to eat meat. So there again, okay. The order of this seems to me rather significant, right? First of all, I like meat too much, and then afterwards, and we're genetically meant to eat meat. You may be familiar with a chapter in a book by a woman, called Joy, M. Joy, who writes about the three M's. Right? The three M's are the reasons, she says, that people give when they're asked why they eat meat. And it reflects these two things I've just said. Okay, so one is, it's natural. Okay, we evolved to do it. Humans are naturally meat eaters. Secondly, it's normal. Everybody does it. And thirdly, it's necessary. It's necessary for a good diet. It's a book called Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs and Wear Cows, An Introduction to Carnism. There is an article, now I know that nobody's read this by anything, because it's in press and I've read it, and nobody else has read it, in the author. No. I've had the privilege of having seen this before it's published, and it's an article called The Four M's, right, which is by Jared Piazza. It's going to come out in the journal Appetite. And he adds to this, he's also a psychologist, based on, again, some rather elaborate survey research about asking people why they eat meat. He says, well, we ought to add to this a fourth M. So people say it's natural, normal, necessary. And they also say very strongly that it's nice, okay? And we know, and I apologize if I'm trespassing on the territory of one of the other talks, that this emotional response to eating is very, very common indeed, okay? Bacon is happiness. So my final reflection is this, and it seems to be an interesting thing, I think. Taste, and go right back to what I said at the beginning, you know, taste is, think of Proust, okay. Taste is something to do with our deepest sense of identity, of memory, of security, right? Of pleasure. And yet, it seems to me, and this is the question I want to leave you with, and yet the debate going on about meat eating and about many other controversies to do with animals, and we've in this research project that I'm doing, we've, you know, we're looking very closely at a number of controversies: animal experiments, hunting, pest control, the badger cull, and all sorts of things like that. The tendency is for people to see these as rational debates, okay? So what are you doing? You've got reason. I believe in animal experiments for this reason, right? I believe in hunting for this reason, okay? Or I don't believe in it for this reason. I'm not being partisan one or another. And yet, the evidence seems to be, on a number of fronts, actually, that the reason comes afterwards, that there is a deep, deep reason, if it's a, it isn't a reason, okay, it appears to be a reason, a deep, deep cause of why people believe or act in the way that they do, and the reasons come afterwards. Now, I don't know what my conclusion is from that, but it almost seems, one could cynically almost feel that it's futile to argue with people on these kind of matters. They are too deep and too emotional, and that's how the marketers certainly think of things. But maybe, I don't know. Okay. So that's what I have to say. I've left you with an open question rather than a conclusion of any kind. And, I had a last question from no less a person than Erica Fudge. Last quotation, I mean. Do you remember saying that?
No.
Well, it's not as straightforward as it seems, actually, because you are commenting on somebody else's remark earlier. But I think that's kind of thematic of what I've been saying. I think what is imbibed in childhood is impossible to leave behind. So one is struggling. What I'm saying really is I think one is dealing with forces more powerful than reason, in a way, and it's a difficult matter with all sorts of implications. And there are some references to things I've referred to in the talk. And I will stop there. I hope that seems to be on time.
Thank you very much indeed.